Hello there, I'm Brian Taylor. Down the years, you may have seen me on the telly or heard me on the wireless, but this is different. This is the Brian Taylor podcast, brought to you by The Herald. I'm speaking to the party leaders, challenging them on their policies, their strategies. You'll laugh, you'll cry, you may even vote.
Scotland's recovery should be in Scotland's hands.
Our focus is on Scotland. The nationalists focus on separation.
We're going to be asking people in Scotland to vote like our future depends on it, because it really does.
Independence would be like Brexit on a rocket to Mars.
Everything that ALBA does in this election will be a positive contribution to building that independence supermajority.
We can choose to focus on what unites us as a country, not what divides us.
Today, we're speaking to Douglas Ross, the leader of the Scottish Conservatives. You'll catch up on the economy, public spending, and his own standing as leader. Let's kick off. It's got to be the pandemic. This is an election in the middle of the pandemic, in the middle of attempts to recover from it. But let's talk about future plans. What are your plans for Scottish economic recovery post the pandemic, if such a thing can be envisaged?
Well, first of all, we want to see some of the restrictions that we're currently living under ease slightly quicker. We are still being cautious and safe with our proposals, but we've looked at the public health evidence, which shows the number of people in hospital is now at its lowest level since October last year. The number of people getting infected with COVID-19, it remains low. The test positivity is down at 2.5%. So we've made immediate proposals to bring forward the restrictions that were due to be eased on the 17th of May to the 26th of April. And we're also actually looking at all the proposals in the route map out of the restrictions and seeking to bring them forward by 3 weeks. And that makes a big difference to a lot of businesses. They can then plan for reopening sooner rather than later in a safe and cautious way. Because at the moment, all the public health evidence suggests we can do that.
How can you be certain it's safe? I mean, we went into lockdown previously, we opened up again, and this hideous plague came rip-roaring back again. Isn't Nicola Sturgeon right to be cautious, perhaps more cautious than you are attempting to be?
Well, the big difference, Brian, is the vaccine. 2.5 million people in Scotland now protected with the vaccine, which we didn't have before we went into the second lockdown. And Nicola Sturgeon herself said that if the public health data supported it, we could move from the current restrictions, effectively level 4, straight to level 2. She said we could do that as a country together if the public health data allowed us. Could isn't must.
And look at the examples from, you know, Germany, France. They were being boasted as being the countries that had tackled coronavirus, and then suddenly it came back again, and they had huge numbers.
But again, Brian, you've got to look at the vaccine rollout in Germany and France and many other EU countries. It is not the same success as we've seen here in Scotland and across the UK. The most vulnerable people in Scotland, 400,000 now protected with both doses, over 2.5 million with the first dose. We're making our way through the JCVI list of the top nine categories to get the vaccine. And it's continuing at pace. And that's been the game changer here, is the vaccine rollout. But sorry, I started answering my question or your question just about...
Economy.
So that is part of it, reopening our economy quicker. But we've also got plans, for example, for job security councils to help people in various sectors if they sadly lose their jobs, to match the skills that they had in a previous job with potentially new employment. That's been a successful model used in Sweden since the 1970s. We've got our Retrain to Rebuild grants, £500 for everyone in Scotland to access training, to upskill, to hopefully get back into employment. We really have a focus in this election on protecting jobs, protecting people's jobs, and hopefully ensuring we can get people back into work if they sadly lose their job.
I'm of sufficient vintage, and I've covered elections forever, you know, back in the Middle Ages. And these sort of projects are endlessly recycled. You know, we had the YTS, we had the Youth Opportunities Programme before that. We hear it. And it's growing the economy that actually matters rather than these. I appreciate you're fighting an election, you're going to be putting forward some proposals, but these sound to me like versions of policies that have been tried in the past. Perhaps they ameliorated the situation a bit, but they didn't really sort problems.
Well, some of these are projects that haven't been and proposals that haven't been adopted in Scotland or indeed the UK before. That's why we've looked at other areas around the world where there has been success. The Job Security Council is one such example. So we've got to look at best practice elsewhere. We've got to look at the challenge we're going to face here in Scotland and across the UK and indeed around the world coming out of this pandemic. The Institute for Fiscal Studies has said our economic recovery will take about as long as it took coming out the financial crisis. So that's the challenge that we're all faced with. And that's why I'm making a big focus on protecting jobs and supporting people over the next few years.
I saw a focus as well from you on projects, perhaps particularly road projects, you know, a three-lane M8 between Glasgow and Edinburgh. Is that really needed? Should we not be focusing upon public transport innovation rather?
Well, we are as well. And that three-lane M8 policy was part of my Build Up Scotland, Power Up Scotland document that I launched within the first month of becoming leader of the Scottish Conservatives, that also looks at connectivity between the main cities around Scotland on rail. It also looks at infrastructure projects out with the Central Belt. So the north of Scotland, the south of Scotland, all parts of Scotland can see the benefits of that infrastructure upgrade as well.
Come to the cash in a minute on the spending in a moment, but you've made a big emphasis, every politician in this election is making a big emphasis upon education. You're talking about recruiting more teachers, you're talking about a national tutoring service. And are you talking about, you know, the moment exams, external exams are on pause, presumably you're talking about bringing back the hires and bringing back other forms of assessment. You know, some are saying they should be dumped altogether.
Well, I think there has to be a form of assessment, and what we've seen is the lack of development from August, when the last exams crisis effectively damaged the opportunities of so many young people until the government U-turned their decision. But nothing was done from that stark warning about the current system. In a pandemic, how do you grade pupils about their success or otherwise in their studies? And I really think they've left it now to the last minute. And that's why we've got so much confusion with young people. They were told there wouldn't be exams, but now there are going to be assessments, which are effectively the same things you would have to study for. Is it just going to be the teacher grades or are there going to be assessments? Why is it going to be different in different parts of the country? Why should a pupil in Aberdeenshire potentially have a different system of assessment to a pupil in Angus?
Let's talk about one policy that you have. You've had it for quite some time. I think it's been back since about 2010. That's the pupil premium. You seem to be going cool on that for a bit, but it's back in action for this election. Can you explain what it is?
Yeah, again, it's back in action because we've seen the disruption that pupils have faced throughout the last year. So it's £120 million. It's directed into the schools to support every pupil to get back up to the level they were hopefully at prior to going into this pandemic, coming away from face-to-face learning. Online learning worked for some. For others, it was really difficult. So it's to try and help this catch up in terms of lost education. Our teachers did a fantastic job. You know, I absolutely congratulate them for everything they did. But the online learning and the assessments that they're trying to now roll out don't compare to getting a pupil back in the classroom and face-to-face learning. And that's where a lot of young people have lost out.
Okay, before we talk about the cost of all of this, and I certainly intend to do so, let's talk about a couple more policies you've announced. 60,000 affordable new homes, including 40,000 in the rented sector. Now, your critics would say that the right to buy council houses denuded the rented sector in the first place. It's a problem that your own party created.
Well, it was created long before I was even born, Brian, which does age me perhaps more than anyone else. But it was a policy that got people onto the housing ladder. And it was one that many people supported because it gave them the opportunity to get on that housing ladder to start to own their first home and then move on. So absolutely, it's an issue that we have to tackle. And that's why we are putting forward the most ambitious social housing drive since devolution.
What about the more generally within local authorities? You're talking about a Barnett-style formula for councils. You say the SNP have removed the equivalent of £1 billion from local councils. Now, they would say, I'm sure, if you were up against an SNP opponent in the debate, they would say they were working within UK budgets. They were, to a large extent, they were working within austerity laid down by successive Conservative chancellors. Again, the Tories created this issue in the first place.
But actually, the figures don't support that, because the £1 billion figure that we have recognised is the shortfall between what councils got back in 2007 before the SNP came to power, the proportion of the Scottish Government budget going to local authorities in 2007 compared to what it was in the last financial year has seen our local councils receive £1 billion less. And that means, because the Barnett formula and the grant funding from the UK government has increased, we're now at record levels of UK government support coming to the Scottish government. That has not been transferred to local government, to councils, who are being asked to do more with less funding from the Scottish government.
You talk about the SNP coming to power in 2007, but in 2008, we had a financial crash, a global financial crisis. Following that, we had the UK, successive UK chancellors, introducing and boldly stating it to be austerity programmes, programmes to rein back on public spending. And Scotland took a hit as a consequence of that. And that would explain why there is constraint in Scottish budgets.
But it doesn't explain now, with record funding going to the Scottish Government, why the local authorities aren't getting their fair share. Why isn't that money transferring from the UK Government to the Scottish Government to local governments? 32 councils across the country are being asked to do more and more each year, but not getting the support to carry out these vital functions. And therefore, they're having to face really difficult choices to make cuts to public services that people rely on day in, day out. You know, one of the biggest... Sorry, Brian. Sometimes the biggest queries we get as elected representatives is about the bin collection moving to three times, every 3 weeks rather than 2 weeks, etc. These are the issues that really matter to people.
Ministers would say that local authorities are getting a fair deal. I hear what you say there. But even accepting your analysis for a moment, and I'm not accepting it or querying it. I'm just taking it as read. If you're going to reinstate the equivalent of £1 billion to local authorities within a fixed budget that the Scottish Government has, unless they send income tax through the roof, within a fixed budget, where would you find the money for this? What would you cut to release this money for local authorities, as you promised to do?
Well, we'd be far more efficient with the projects we carry out.
Everybody always talks about efficiency. Every politician in history says efficiency savings. And goodness sake, don't try that one on me.
Well, we have to try it, Brian, because we had the IT system for the Common Agricultural Policy payments that was a huge failure and a cost of several million pounds. We've got hospitals that were years late in being opened. We've got ferries that have been built that have never been in the water. These are all projects that have cost the Scottish taxpayer hundreds of millions of pounds. And if we had been more efficient as a government here in Scotland with these projects, we would have more money to spend on the frontline vital services that people rely on.
There are always problems in government, and these are individual problems. The ones you were talking about, the hospital programmes, they are capital projects for the most part. I mean, for goodness sake, wasn't there an example of the UK government placing an order with a company that had never built ships in the past? I mean, these things happen in government. It is not released £1 billion for councils to have efficiency savings and building hospitals a bit more quickly.
It absolutely does release more funding, though, for all local services, be they local council services, for our NHS, for education, etc. And we have seen, as I've said, local councils bear the brunt of the cuts from the Scottish Government, despite record funding from the UK Government coming to Holyrood.
What would you cut? You'd have to cut something. You'd have to find constraints somewhere if you're going to fund local authorities at a higher level. And I stress again, ministers say they are funded fairly.
Well, we already know, though, from the Scottish Government's own figures, that there are £4.8 billion of unallocated capital spend, so that money can go to local authorities. And as I say...
You're going to spend all the backup cash. You're going to spend all the money that's in the savings bank.
That's not backup cash. That is money that is available here in Scotland to invest that has not been. And that's why we can look at rolling out full fibre broadband to every home and business property in Scotland by using some of that funding. That funding is there to be spent. Why are we sitting on this money when councils and others are struggling at the moment?
Let's talk about, that's the spending side of things. I'm going to come on more of that in a minute. But let's talk about the revenue side of things. The Scottish Parliament doesn't have full tax powers, but it has very substantial tax powers, powers over rates and bands in income tax. What's your, I appreciate you'll give us the detail when you set forward your own policies. If you were to be in power, you would give us the detail when your finance secretary was laying these things out. But what's your general approach on income taxation in Scotland? What's the principle underlying it?
So the underlying principle is to get parity back into the tax system, so people in Scotland are not taxed more to do the same job of those south of the border. So we want to, over the course of the parliament, we accept in these exceptional times, it will take longer to get our economy back up and running. But when we do, we want to see a fairness back in the tax system so people in Scotland are not the highest taxed of anyone in the United Kingdom.
Now, the SNP ministers, again, would dispute that very substantially. They would say that in terms of the overall levy, the money raised in Scotland is fair. They would say that the money lands upon those who are in the upper brackets, and that those who are earning low to middle income are actually doing better in Scotland than they do under the UK system.
But our tax policies here in Scotland under the SNP means my wife, who's a police officer, is taxed more than those south of the border. So why? This is not high earners. This is our teachers, our police officers and others who are suffering as a result of these tax policies of the SNP. And I think having that parity back in the system again, it takes us back to fairness.
I'm struck by that word parity. Are you talking about, you know, reverting the Scottish system to be exactly the same as the Treasury? Because we have a different bands in Scotland and different rates for those bands as well.
So what we've said is we will continue to support those who have benefited, those on the lowest incomes who benefit in Scotland. But we want those who are currently paying higher tax in Scotland for doing the exact same job as south of the border. We want them to stop paying that extra tax because it doesn't just affect those in those roles. It also affects investment. People are more reluctant to base people and staff and offices in Scotland if they know they're going to have a higher tax bill for doing the exact same work north of the border than they would south of the border.
So on the upper bands, you bring back the Treasury levels of the bands and you know, remove, for example, the 41% rate.
So that's all what we're going to look at over the course of the Parliament, because it's not going to be something that we could stand up and say on week one, this is what we're doing. But we want to give people in Scotland the assurance that that is what we'd look at over the course of the five-year Parliament.
Might you offer to cut Scottish income tax below the level for England?
So I'd love to do that, but again, I'm realistic with the current situation, and I think people accept after the last 12 months with major government intervention in terms of the furlough scheme, self-employed income support, all the support that's gone to businesses, I think it could have got to businesses quicker in Scotland. I think people understand that while parties may be ambitious to do that, now is not the time when we've got to secure the current economy, improve it. But, you know, going forward, I certainly don't want Scotland to be the highest tax part of the United Kingdom.
Right, let's park that. I'm going to come to independence in a moment, but let's talk about a couple more policy areas first. Justice. You're talking about scrapping the not proven verdict. It would be guilty or not guilty. Now, Nicola Sturgeon is now matching that from the SNP Scottish Government perspective. You say you'd put victims at the heart of the system. I mean, that sounds to me the sort of slightly vague, slightly vacuous promise that can be made. Does it mean anything in practice? Because presumably you have to protect the rights of the accused as well.
So it absolutely does mean something in practice. And if I come on to a couple of examples at the moment, but I am pleased now that other political parties in Scotland are accepting that the not proven verdict, one that is, you know, almost unique in legal circles around the world to the Scottish justice system, is one that is used disproportionately in rape cases. And it doesn't provide clarity or any finality in these cases. And while I welcome the SNP position now during an election campaign, I do wonder why it's not happened in the years running up to this. But take, for example, trying to get victims back into the system and giving them more rights and more opportunity to be heard. One of our proposals is if someone is convicted of murdering someone and they will not release the information of where their remains have been buried or hidden, they should never be liable to parole. And that comes off the back of a family who continued to search for a loved one whose convicted murderer keeps those details secret. That family have been left without an end to this whole process. They can't lay a loved one to rest because a killer still has this hanging over them, that power over this family by not revealing where the body is buried. So that's one example of how we would put victims back at the centre of the justice system.
Let's turn to health spending. You're promising to increase the budget by £2 billion by the end of the Parliament, admittedly over a five-year period. But let's talk about an issue that is raised right now. In power in the UK, your Conservative Party is offering just 1% pay rise to nurses and others. Nicola Sturgeon's Scottish Government is offering 4%. in the same circumstances.
Yeah, and obviously we've heard in the week that we're discussing this, Brian, that the unions here in Scotland are looking for more than 4%. But I, you know, back the 4% increase here in Scotland. I also think we've got to look at other frontline workers. Our NHS staff and our nurses and everyone within the NHS has done an outstanding job in the last year. But so have our police officers, our local authority workers, our teachers, etc. So we've got to look at how we recognise the efforts of everyone that's been involved in this pandemic.
So you think the 1% offer by the UK government to, for example, nurses in England is parsimonious, or to use a blunter word, cheapskate?
So what I was going to say, how that compares to the UK government is we have a different system in England where the UK government put forward a proposal and then it goes to an independent panel to determine that. They take the government's view, they take the union's view, they speak to staff and they come up with the final answer in terms of the payment increase that will go to...
They may have a different system, but they have the same arithmetic and 1% is a quarter of 4%. So are your colleagues south of the border being cheapskate with the nurses?
Well, the Prime Minister has already said, while putting forward the 1%, he is also keen that the peer review body looks at every opportunity to increase what our nurses are getting. So I think we've just got to see how that independent process away from politicians ultimately comes down on this. And as I say, we've already had some differing views on the 4% offer here in Scotland as well.
Still an idea where you perhaps you've taken a different perspective from your UK government. Colleagues, that's COVID passports, you know, the idea that you could, you know, guarantee you've had a vaccination program, etc., allowing you access to certain services. You've said you have significant reservations about that. Why is that?
Yeah, so if I can split it in two, Brian, first of all, I think it is understandable and people would accept that for international travel, we may have to provide some form of documentation because the third country requires it. So if you fly into Greece, you will need to have a vaccine passport of some kind, and people understand that. Where I don't think there is fairness and it creates a two-tier system is to have it for domestic travel or business.
Why should restaurants or pubs, for example.
Exactly. You know, restaurants, pubs, cinemas, etc. Because there are younger people in particular who will be several weeks, months away from getting a vaccine. So through no fault of their own, they can't get that passport. They couldn't get that access. There are others, for very good reasons, who can't get the vaccine. My wife, for example, heavily pregnant, can't be vaccinated. So why should she be treated differently than someone who has been able to be vaccinated? So that's why I'm saying, you know, we've got to look at the trials. The trials may resolve some of these issues, but I do have serious reservations that as we all came into this pandemic together, introducing vaccine passports would create a two-tier system coming out of it that I don't think is helpful.
Is there also a danger that vaccine passports could frankly stimulate a pretty substantial black market?
Absolutely. And the Scottish hospitality industry, I was reading some of their concerns about this. One, there's extra work to check everything, and they are worried about fraudulent vaccine passports and that side of things that adds in an awful lot of complexity and uncertainty into the system. But the main thing is, you know, if we keep going with the vaccines, everyone gets covered with that, and we start to see an ease of restrictions, I'm hopeful we don't need them at all.
We've talked about issues where you take a slightly different perspective from the Prime Minister on a policy issue. Just look at the character and the personality of Boris Johnson generally. Do you consider him an asset to your campaign in Scotland at these elections?
Yeah, you just have to look at what the UK government has done over the last year. People know their jobs have been protected by Boris Johnson, UK government, introducing the furlough scheme, one of the most generous furlough schemes anywhere in the world, the self-employed income support. And the decisions he and his government took right at the start of this pandemic to start procuring and developing a number of different vaccines.
But as That's a personality, why... as a character, is he an asset or a liability to your campaign here in Scotland?
Well, what I'm saying is people can see the benefits of being part of the UK and benefits of decisions taken by the UK government that allow us to see light at the end of the tunnel now, allow us to look more forward than backwards in respect to this pandemic because of decisions that the UK government, which he leads, has taken.
Will the Prime Minister be joining you on the campaign trail in Scotland during these elections in Scotland?
I'm really not sure because as we discussed right at the very beginning of this, Brian, this is such a unique campaign. It's so different to any other we've ever been involved in. You've been involved in far more than me, but never would you have done this type of interview over a computer. And that means our campaigning is very different as well. But he'll be involved, whether it's virtually, making comments, etc. But whether he can physically get up here or not, we're not sure.
You previously said he would be coming. You said on the BBC Sunday show, the Prime Minister will be up here, and I quote,
Yep, no, I did say that because at the time that looked like a possibility. things changed during the campaign. We were going to see an easing to allow canvassing happening earlier on in the campaign than is now currently scheduled. So everything changes as the whole pandemic continues to ebb and flow. But the main thing is we can see the end in sight.
One thing that changed, of course, was that you say everything changes. One thing that changed was, of course, the leadership of your party. Why was Jackson Carlaw ousted from the leadership? What was going wrong?
Well, Jackson Carlaw took the decision. It was over the summer. He reflected and he decided to step back from frontline politics.
Come on, he was given a pretty hefty shove, for goodness sake.
No, you
say I've been covering a few elections. Don't try that one, for goodness sake. He was given a gentle or not so gentle shove, wasn't he?
Well, you know, you have to go back to what Jackson said at the time, and he reflected on his own time as leader and thought it was an opportunity at that stage to allow the party to elect a new leader. But I'm delighted Jackson is standing for Eastwood again. He's been an excellent constituency MSP there, and I'm sure the people of Eastwood will return him to Holyrood.
Your rivals, Mr. Ross, have lampooned you for conservative local leaflets which have Ruth Davidson's picture on the front page, but not yours. Have you been sidelined, as they're suggesting?
No, absolutely not. I'm also on those leaflets. And indeed, since August, when I became leader and Ruth agreed to come back to frontline politics, we've been on the leaflets. This is nothing new. But I would say, you know, why wouldn't we use a great asset such as Ruth Davidson? She is one of the strongest campaigners for Scotland's place in the United Kingdom. She's been one of our most successful leaders in Scotland. And while other parties may not want to work very closely with former leaders, I'm absolutely delighted and pleased and will continue to work closely with Ruth.
Talking about working closely with leaders, you wanted a sort of pan-unionist coalition with Labour and the Liberal Democrats. And yet at the same moment, almost simultaneously, you were saying that Labour, for example, not just weak on the union, but weak full stop. I mean, that's scarcely the way to win friends and allegiances. Was this just a stunt to keep your party at the head of the unionist pack, so to speak?
No, not at all. I think people in this election understand the threat of another independence referendum if the SNP get a majority. I made the offer, I think, within 24 hours of Alex Salmond's comeback into Scottish politics and seeking to game the system to have a supermajority. Labour and the Liberal Democrats refused that offer. They don't want to work in the successful way I think we did previously with Better Together. And therefore, people have a choice then if they want to have a strong pro-UK party that can stop the SNP, as the Scottish Conservatives did in 2016. They have to support Scottish Conservatives again 5 years later in this election in 2021, particularly with their party list vote.
But you know the difference. Better Together was during a referendum, and in the referendum, a single organisation had to emerge as the main campaign organisation on either side to be recognised by the Electoral Commission. This is an election when a whole range of parties are offering that. It wasn't serious that they were going to row in behind you, was it?
Well, it absolutely was. And it was that Better Together spirit that I was calling on to see the parties working together, as we have previously done. It was successful in 2014 to stop the SNP and the Nationalists separating Scotland from the rest of the UK. The threat is again very real. And I've said, I think the future of the country is at stake in this election. So we've got to respond to that threat.
You say the threat is very real, but you know, you're not powerless in this regard. The Constitution is reserved to Westminster. The power to hold a referendum is reserved to Westminster. In 2014, it had to be given by, or conceded after negotiations, conceded by David Cameron. Why doesn't the Prime Minister just put a halt to all of this and say, not happening, not going to grant a referendum, going to veto it, and you know, completely car the feet, if you like, from the SNP and the offer from others?
Because that's not enough for the SNP, because you'll also be aware they've put forward an 11-point plan to achieve Scottish independence. And I think number two in that plan is to hold a referendum, even regardless of getting a Section 30 order. So they're willing to say to the people of Scotland, they want a referendum in the next couple of years. They've accepted that would be in a recovery phase. And they're also, as a party, proposing with the 11-point plan to not even need a Section 30 order. We heard Alex Salmond speaking this week, suggesting that negotiations on an independent Scotland could start of day one of the next Scottish Parliament. That's not where the focus should be.
But you wouldn't accept that sort of plebiscite as being a final decision, a final and binding decision. It would have to be a legally constituted referendum, the result of which would be recognised by international bodies. Why doesn't Boris Johnson just say in the middle of this campaign, look, guys, get used to it, isn't going to happen?
Well, I've already said I wouldn't accept and take part in any illegal wildcat referendum. I'd boycott it and advise everyone else to do the same. But that uncertainty of another referendum campaign, whether it's with a Section 30 order or not, is what leads to businesses questioning whether they should invest in Scotland. It puts people's jobs at risk. And crucially, at this moment, it would put our recovery at risk. And that's where we need the focus of the Scottish Government, the Scottish Parliament, and everyone within Scottish politics on our recovery and rebuilding Scotland, not another referendum.
But you could thwart it with a veto from the PM. You're basically trying to stir up fear and anxiety on the one hand, hoping to benefit electorally on the other.
But it wouldn't thwart it with the SNP saying they will go ahead with a referendum regardless. That's what Mike Russell, as their constitution spokesperson, put forward. Ian Blackford, as the SNP leader at Westminster, has suggested that referendum could be held this year. And we know the SNP have apparently allocated £600,000 of party funds to fight a referendum this year. That's where their focus is, not on our recovery.
Let's close, Mr. Ross, by talking about a little bit about yourself, about your. Congratulations upon the impending birth. When is
22nd of June?
Okay, just not long after the elections. Well, congratulations upon that. But let's look at history and look at the future as well. A sort of combination of the two. Do you accept that the Tories were something of a toxic brand in Scotland? And if so, how do you propose to dispel that forever?
Well, we've seen a progression over the last few elections of the Scottish Conservatives becoming a clear opposition to the SNP in terms of Holyrood representation, Westminster representation and local government representation. We are the second party to the SNP, and I would contrast that with Scottish Labour, who, if you were speaking 25 years ago, people would have said, you know, they were going to dominate Scottish politics forever. Mm-hmm. Since devolution in 1999, they have lost votes and lost MSPs at every single election. So I think our fortunes continue to go up, while the Scottish Labour Party continues to go down.
And you're a linesman in old money, and an assistant referee. Is that the posh term these days?
That's,
I suppose,
it.
Used a few rough comments. Let's close with this. The Conservatives previously opposed devolution. They saw Westminster as being the debating and the legislative chamber that would govern Scotland. You are currently a Westminster MP for Moray. Are you absolutely committed to a career at Holyrood as an MSP, absolutely without peradventure committed?
Absolutely. And three of the five Scottish First Ministers have also been MP and MSP at the same time. So it can be done, it has been done. And I actually think most people just want our two governments to start working better together, and therefore having a representative in both Holyrood and Westminster is someone who can raise issues on behalf of the people of Scotland in both of Scotland's parliaments. And I think that's a positive thing.
But why not stand for a Holyrood constituency? You're not standing for a constituency. You're only on the list, and the SNP say you're only standing on the list so that when your party bombs at the election in May, you can just shuttle off the list as quickly as possible and go back to being an MP.
Well, I'll answer the point in a second, but all parties have candidates who are only standing on the list, including the SNP, and I don't think they're undermining their list-only candidates.
Yeah, but not their leader, and not their leader. Their leader is standing in a constituency, and it is not that common for the leader only to stand on the list. It's usually standing on a constituency, and it's understandable, put a big name at the top of the list to attract votes. But yeah. why not stand for a constituency? Why not put your name forward for a constituency?
So to answer that question 100%, it comes down to I have only ever stood in one constituency in my life. It's a constituency right. I was born and brought up in. Murray has elected me and re-elected me as their Member of Parliament. But when I became leader of the Scottish Conservatives, we had already in place an excellent local candidate in Tim Eagle. I'm determined to see him elected MSP for Murray. But I was not going to put myself forward to another constituency where we didn't have a candidate within the Highlands and Islands region, because I'm committed to, you know, standing up for my Murray seat, which I, as I say, been elected and re-elected to, and it's the only seat since I first started seeking elected office at a national level in 2010. It's the only seat I've ever stood in.
Your critics will say that's pretty convenient, and again, I'm old enough to quite cover this one, but 1962, when Alec Douglas Hume needed a seat in the House of Commons, I think it was George Younger actually stood aside for him in Perth and Kinross. So the Tories are pretty good at shifting these things around if it's needed. I can't imagine that the pre-existence of a candidate in Murray was the obstacle to you. If you wanted this, you could have sorted it. You got rid of Jackson Carlow, for goodness sake. You could have got rid of the candidate for Murray.
Well, the example you cite from 1962 was over three decades before I was even born. As I say, you know, we do have an excellent candidate in Tim Eagle, the leader of our Conservative group there. I'm doing everything I can to see him be elected. And I hope to see Tim joining me in Holyrood as part of a strong Scottish Conservative team.
Final question. Are you, as a party, as a leader, absolutely committed to the devolved Scottish Parliament? There are still arguments that are advanced by some, not maybe directly from Conservatives, but some from the right of politics, saying that the Parliament should be scrapped, it should be reined back, it should be reined in. The Tories previously opposed devolution. You previously opposed proportional representation. Your party was revived by devolution and proportional representation in Scotland. Are you absolutely committed to the continuing existence of the Scottish Parliament?
Absolutely committed to the continuing existence of the Scottish Parliament. That's from me as leader, the Scottish Conservatives, all our elected officials, all our candidates. But what we'd like to see is a Scottish Parliament that's focused on delivering for people across Scotland, not just on narrow party agendas, which is sadly what we've seen from the SNP over the last 14 years.
Do you expect to be First Minister in May?
I am ever hopeful, but opinion polls would currently suggest that the people across Scotland have a different role for me, but I am working over the next 4 weeks to get as much support for the Scottish Conservatives, because we know the threat from the SNP is real. This is an election that they are framing as an opportunity to hold another independence referendum. Therefore, people have to unite behind the Scottish Conservatives as the strongest party to stop that, to allow us as a country, as Scotland, as a parliament, as politicians, to focus on our recovery. And if we can do that, then I think that will be far better for the people of Scotland than another damaging, divisive referendum.
Douglas Ross, thank you very much indeed for joining me for this Herald podcast. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Brian.
This podcast was brought to you by The Herald. We're giving you the chance to get exclusive access to even more insight, analysis and opinion with a Herald subscription. Take 20% off an annual rate with the code HeraldNew2021. This offer is for new subscribers only and is only available with the promotional code. Subscriptions will renew at the standard rate unless cancelled. And sign up to our free evening politics newsletter, Unspun, to get snap analysis from some of our top contributors every day. Head to heraldscotland.com for the details. Thank you.